You're listening to the Animation Addicts Podcast with the Rotoscopers, episode 31, The Little Mermaid. Now with more product placement.
This episode is brought to you by Netflix.com. Netflix is an amazing resource for animated films and regular live action films. You can go there and you can watch on your computer, TV, or iPod or iPad, and you can get them right at your fingertips. You can also get movies mailed to you. So, I mean, if you have an animation craving, go to therotoscopers.com/Netflix for a free 1 month trial. This is an amazing, easy way to support the podcast because, let's be honest, you're watching movies anyway. You might as well help the podcast while you're at it. So one more time, for your free 1 month trial of Netflix, go to therotoscopers.com/Netflix. Welcome to the 1 year anniversary episode of the Animation Addicts Podcast with the Rotoscopers. Disney, DreamWorks, Pixar, Don Bluth, and everything in between. I'm your host, Morgan Stradling, and I'm here with my amazing animated co-hosts, Chelsea Robson.
Hey, hey.
And Mason Smith.
Howdy, y'all.
The Texan.
How's Texas?
Dude, I'm living it up. Hey, okay, I just figured out something really cool yesterday in one of my viz classes. My professor in that class is named Frederick Park. He is credited as the very first person to ever make a CG model of a human face.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, someone just asked him, like, hey, we heard that you were the first person to model a human face. And he's like, yeah, that's right. That was like 1972, I think he said.
Wow.
Or 1971. But yeah, it's pretty funny. Actually, if you go on the internet and you look him up, on Wikipedia it says he's about 100 years old, which isn't true. It says he was born in 1913.
Oh, that's
so
funny.
I don't know, diet and exercise, but yeah. it's really cool. If you go on Amazon, he has a book about animating human faces. Because once he modeled that human face, he was able to get it rigged to animate. And so I just thought that was really cool. He didn't do that at A&M. He was at University of Utah up there when he was doing his graduate work and when he accomplished that. But yeah, I just thought that was really cool. And he was totally like, oh, okay, let's move on about it. You know, he wasn't like, I don't know, he didn't want to
waste
time. I guess
he
didn't want the spotlight to be on him for very long, which was cool. So yeah, like, that was pretty crazy. But yeah, I just wanted to share that. I just found that out yesterday. I was like, whoa, I got to put that on the podcast.
You're hobnobbing with the big dogs over there.
Whatever hobnobbing means, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You hobnobber, you.
I don't know what that means.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
Keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros, two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude, stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
Neither do I. I'm just rolling with it.
Moving on. Let's go to the news.
Do the news. Oh, Okay, so since our last episode, there have been lots of news. So it's new year and new things are happening. So the first one, this happened about a week or so ago, is that the Frozen posters were revealed. And turns out they were fake. So what happened was there's a website called Cine One. It's an Argentinian website. Shout out to Mason. It's like a movie website that, you know, deals with cinematic news in that country and all around the world. And so these posters got posted. Get it? And posting them and putting them on their websites and saying, oh, and there was all this hullabaloo about what the characters looked like. And then, you know, a few hours later found out that the posters were fake. But the big reveal... Okay,
so the posters are fake, but the renders that we saw aren't, right?
Yeah, the characters were real. And so, like, first people were like, oh my gosh, I'm so happy those aren't the characters. Like, good thing. Disney is way better than that. And then it was actually guys, those are actually real. Like, a few Disney employees went out and said, hey, those are real characters, but fake posters. So apparently someone had access to the, you know, the models, and they kind of just posed them however they wanted and made these fake posters. So a good because people finally got to see what Elsa and people see what Anna looked like, but they got to see that. And then a downside was the reaction was pretty negative.
Well, what did people have wrong with them?
I think people were saying, like, specifically Elsa's design. They said that they were just really disappointed in her. They thought that maybe both of them, they kind of looked unrendered, or they look like animation from 5 years ago. And I think a lot of people really thought that Elsa was going to be this old school villain. You know, they'd seen these old concept art from about 2006 where she's wearing these luscious furs and she's older. She's like in her 40s and very mature. And turns out, no, she's like early 20s, if that, in these posters. I mean, they're sisters within a few years of each other, not sisters with like a 20-year gap. And so I think people were just disappointed when Elsa turned out to be, you know, she's supposed to be the big bad guy of the movie, you know, so we are told. And she's just kind of like beautiful and Disneyfied and happy and not villainous, not Maleficent in any way.
Well, I think that's a good move on Disney, because, you know, they're already upping the suspense, because it's like, oh, she's just a young girl. How bad of a villain can she be? Mm-hmm. You know, but, you know, as Disney has shown that it knows how to properly animate, and they're going to pull it off. It's just that they're like, you know, they're already pulling the wool over audiences' eyes with her character design. I don't know. If it was this, like, typical Maleficent-style villain, then people would be like, oh, it's just a typical Maleficent-style villain.
Yeah, we already have a Maleficent.
Exactly. We already have a Maleficent, and there cannot be any more Maleficent. but I just like it because it's unexpected. You know that she's the villain at some point. And the fact that they're so close in age makes it an even more intimate and possibly tragic relationship when, you know, when there's some sort of villain heroine thing going on. So that's my soapbox on people's beef about Elsa's design.
What did you think about it personally?
What did I think about it personally?
Yeah.
I think it's cool. The first thing I thought was, oh my gosh, this has got to be the same universe as Tangled, because it's like kind of the same character style. And I don't know. I think they look cool. Like, I really don't have any complaints about it.
Yeah, I agree. And we are in the minority, just so you know. Which is interesting to me, because I thought people would have liked them.
Yeah. Whatever. We're going to flock to this movie.
Yeah. So if anybody wants to know any more about what we've talked about here, you can actually go to our YouTube site. Yay, YouTube!
Yeah, YouTube.
We've gotten a few videos on there as well. So we discuss a few more with characters and everything. It's great. So check it out.
Okay, so the next bit of news is DreamWorks Animation. They have bumped back the release date of one of their films, Mr. Peabody and Sherman, to March 17. So that was
kind of hard.
Anytime something gets bumped back, there's big reasons for it. And another bit that goes along with this, there are massive cuts to the studio staff that'll also be happening at the same time, maybe as a reason because of this. Around 500 employees are expected to lose their jobs.
Ooh, ouch.
You know, and so the thing about this was it was supposed to come out this year, November 2013, and it wouldn't have been head-to-head with Frozen. Frozen was going to come out a few weeks after. So it's kind of like the Wreck-It Ralph, Rise of the Guardians thing flipped. Wreck-It Ralph came out first and then Rise of the Guardians. But Rise of the Guardians, I think, is one of the reasons why this happened. It just didn't catch on with American audiences. It made barely over $100 million in box office for the U.S. domestic, about doubled its budget with revenues, which, I mean, isn't a huge failure. I mean, that's great. Anytime you double your money, I think it's awesome. But
I mean, it is said that they had to take around $94 to $96 million write-off on this film. And so I think the lack of success with Rise of the Guardians caused the studio cuts, which moved Peabody and Sherman. And with that, the big movie that a lot of people were excited about that was supposed to come out in March 2014 was Me and My Shadow. And yeah. Now Me and My Shadow has been pushed in back into development. So that's not good. Anytime you're pushed back into development, you're going backwards, not forwards. And so who knows when we'll see that movie now, if ever, because apparently a lot of that staff has been cut as well.
Well, it could just mean that they're making a lot of creative changes that they think will be better. This all reminds me of the documentary I watched last night that I guess we're going to talk about in a second. With Beauty and the Beast, they had all these ideas. And then after watching the first 20 minutes of it, I think it was Jeffrey Katzenberg and everybody else was like, no, we're going to redo this whole thing. It's not going to work. And that was probably its back in development stage. So maybe I'm just being overly optimistic about it, but massive cuts to the studio staff plus bumping back all these films equals this is bad for DreamWorks. Like, seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm no expert, but it's just looking that way.
Yeah. And I mean, you have to look at it from a business side. I mean, if they're losing money and they have too many people employed, well, you have to cut back. I mean, I'm the business person here. I'm getting my MBA. Like, I see it from, the business side. And yes, hundreds of people are being hurt and affected and their families as well. But I mean, it's better that than the studio going out of business within a few years because of these poor decisions that were made.
Right. And it's not like they're going to get any help from government, nor would we want them to. So that's just my...
Yeah, stay out of our animation.
Wouldn't that be horrible, though? Like, oh, man.
It's called the Ad Council, Chelsea.
I think that this is kind of a cause of rapid expansion. Like, they were expanding too quickly. They've been on board. They were going to release about 3 films a year, which was very, very ambitious. Disney hadn't even been to that point during its heyday in the Renaissance. And I've seen this in my classes as we've studied different companies. When you expand too quickly, many times, this happened with JetBlue, it happened with Starbucks, you realize that you can't keep up with it and you kind of are just running and gaining momentum, but you're not in control. And so I think this is what happened, is they kind of expanded too much, too quick. And now they're realizing, no, okay, we gotta take a step back. So now they're going from three films a year to 2, which let's let them manage 2 and then see where they can go from there.
Hey, like I said, I'm no expert.
Neither am I. I just like to talk.
Hey, we love it. And, and speaking of expanding and growing in studios, so focusing on one young and ambitious studio, to quote Morgan, have you all heard about The Box Trolls, this new film coming out by Leica and Focus Features?
I saw some, very small concept art for it, but I don't really know what it's about.
It's on the website if you want to check it out. So stop motion /3D hybrid film to be released in October 2014, right?
Yes.
Basically what I got out of this, if you don't want to be spoiled about the synopsis, then just skip ahead. But it's there's these box trolls that live in the underground of this really prissy, fancy city. but they're not really trolls. They're just outcasts. And so to be accepted by this high society place, this exterminator wants to kill them all. That sounds like Leica, yeah. And so there's a thing where they have to come together and kind of a Pocahontas avatar thing of merging of two worlds.
Oh my.
And it sounds really cool, but they keep mentioning cheese in the article that I watched, that I looked on. And so, yeah, it seems really quirky. Something about cheese. They keep mentioning cheese.
It's they keep talking about 4 times cheese. And
yeah, so a pretty cheesy film, right, guys?
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, that'll be cool. Leica, it's up and coming,
Yeah, it only has 2 movies under its belt, Coraline and Paranorman. Both of those have been very critically acclaimed, very, very good movies. They sort of, Leica has this theme running throughout its movies, which is they deal with sort of monsters or the supernatural or kind of just creep factor. And this definitely fits the bill. So I don't think we'll be seeing any fairy tale unicorns and rainbows coming from Leica anytime soon, unless it's zombified. But yeah, so what I really like about this movie is that the president of Leica, he kind of said it's Dickens meets Monty Python, and kind of with a steampunk twist.
Okay. Yeah. Just saying that makes me happy.
Well, steampunk rules.
Which is kind of very trendy right now.
It's very trendy.
I'm just saying it. So I think they're definitely playing off that. Hopefully the steampunk trend will continue. But I think this is a cool twist on what they're doing for a movie. So I'm excited to see it in 2 years. Not too shabby. We can see this a year and a half from now. Obviously, they've probably been in production about 6 months pre-production or whatnot. But normally they were 3 years between Coraline and Paranorman. So this will be essentially three between Paranorman and that too. So good for them. I'm really excited. That's going to be a good one.
Okay, so for our, the return of the nerdy couch discussion, I always get excited about these, and this one's really cool. We've gotten requests from fans about watching this documentary called Waking Sleeping Beauty. That's a documentary about the Disney Renaissance, and so it covers a period from 1984 to 1994, with a little bit of background history mixed in, and it talks about the slump that Disney Animation went through for a while, meeting its diminuendo with the Black Cauldron, which I didn't think was that bad. But anyway, so after that, Disney brings in more staff. It kind of goes through how they brought it back, bringing in the teams that would bring you Little Mermaid, and then four films after that that would just knock everyone's socks off. And so that period is called the Disney Renaissance in animation lingo. And I really liked it. It wasn't like the most exciting documentary, but my general reaction to it was like, if you want to know like who's who in Disney animation and kind of get an overview of the story, kind of like a Disney animation history 101, as far as the Renaissance go, then you need to see this documentary because it was really fascinating. What did y'all think?
Yeah. When they were getting the ideas to make this, what happened was Peter Schleifer, he had read a bunch of different books that had been written about that time period where Michael Eisner had been in charge. Books, for example, like Disney War, as we've talked about on the show before, that you can get off of audible.com. I read that book and it was just like a really deep expansion of this movie. And so he kind of takes it in a way of, this is what the animators felt about that time period, as opposed to just from an outsider's perspective. So this is like their perspective on the inside. And I loved it. There's so many different facets to this show, to this story, that I could just talk for hours on. And if we really, really wanted to, we could do like a total 2 hour discussion just about the book and this documentary that you can also get on Amazon.com. If you want to head on over to our affiliate link, you can order it from there.
So let me tell you about the Disney Renaissance. So, okay, so the Disney Renaissance, we have to build it up by talking about the dark ages of Disney animation, which is known as the 80s. And so what happened was, around the beginning of the 80s, Walt Disney had been dead for about 15 years. Disney really hadn't put out a fairy tale, since the 50s, which was Sleeping Beauty. It just wasn't a good place. They were like Mason said, they were doing things like the Black Cauldron, and even Walt Disney didn't even see the company or the animation studio as being anything important. It was sort of just like a write-off. It was like a nonprofit, just because it was the company's heritage. Like, we kind of have to stick with it just because, but it's not adding anything of value. So, really, way to be an animator in the 80s at Disney when you're not respected by even the company you work for. So what happened was Michael Eisner came in from Paramount, and he brought in with him Jeffrey Katzenberg and, a few other people with him, and they really kind of revamped the studio. So this wasn't quite there yet. Little Mermaid hadn't been released, but they put Roy Disney at the head of Disney Animation and said, who wants to take animation? He's like, I'll do it, you know? And so Roy kind of had the reins for a little while. And then Jeffrey kind of, he became the one that really drove Disney Animation during the late 80s, early 90s. He was kind of the chairman of that, with Roy kind of leading the way. So, you know, after Black Cauldron flopped, you know, there were all these other studios like Don Bluth's studio and, you know, Steven Spielberg was doing American Tail, you know, that were really succeeding in animation. And so it kind of lit a fire in Disney, and they've been working on Little Mermaid. It had kind of been lit since like 1985, 1984. So they were working on it. And really what happened was Disney just recreated itself after Roger Rabbit. That had some success, and so they released Little Mermaid, and it was a slam dunk for Disney. It was kind of the perfect storm, as we would say. And, you know, so what was different about this is it was completely new. You know, they brought on Howard Ashman and Alan Menken, and they, you know, they brought this Broadway-style musical to animation, which really hadn't been done before. This was new. This was exciting. And even Broadway-style musicals had died in the 1970s, which was sad. So this was kind of new and exciting. And, you know, Little Mermaid was a huge success. They didn't bring in, like, stunt casting, like Bette Midler or, you know, some of the other people they'd tried to use in Oliver and Company. I mean, they brought in a little unknown actress, which was Jodie Benson. So all these, like, events really combined and made Little Mermaid super successful. And, you know, Walt Disney Animation was back, which was exciting. And so then, you know, as we see, they kind of added and continued this Broadway formula to these other movies. And they're all kind of the same. You know, the girl, you know, has this sad situation that happens, and she sings this big ballad about overcoming and, you know, usually about love. And then she would go and she would, you know, achieve her goal, achieve her dream, and there would be a few other like quirky musical numbers in between. So anyways, they did this with Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and Lion King. And I'd say for me, that's kind of the Disney Renaissance. And the tail end of the Disney Renaissance is kind of where it went bad. It was, you know, with Pocahontas, they were trying to do different things there, which I'll get into. But Pocahontas through Tarzan is the end of the Disney Renaissance. It's okay, but it wasn't what it was in the early 90s. So, yeah, what thoughts do you have from the movie or just like this beginning stage of the Renaissance?
It was cool because they introduced a lot of the big people in Disney animation, like in the film, but like in like the 80s, you know. Mm-hmm. So like, you see Glenn King, you see, you know, the nine old men, Don Bluth is there, you know, before he had left. You know, and others that, you know, there's just so many. Yeah, I just thought it was like super cool. One thing that I noticed is that animators from the 80s, like they act just like animation students and interns and animators today. Like they have like this super creative energy and they're always like goofing off. I mean, it makes it look like they were always goofing off. I mean, there was a ton of work, obviously. But like, it was cool to see like they're like, you know, they're like happy animated side of them, you know, because you kind of have to be that type of person to do this job. You know, and I loved it when it was like when it goes to Tim Burton and he's just this really sad looking kid drawing. Oh. And he just like looks at the camera and then goes back to what he's doing. So
hasn't changed much.
Well, I mean, with documentaries, you can kind of manipulate things with that. But
of course,
like it was so freaking funny to watch. So, yeah, I thought it was really cool. It did a really good job, and I appreciated the no fairy tales look about it. Like, these were businessmen, they were out to make money, but they also had to create the magic, you know? And it was cool to see how they brought it back from the low points to Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, and so forth. I really think Howard Ashman brought like a huge change of Disney animation, because you're right, Morgan. It's like when they first brought this kind of Broadway musical quality to animation, and it really fit. It was the future of animation as they knew it when they started, and it just brought this like huge, huge, amazing thing to it. And it's kind of sad to see that recent hand-drawn, you know, Disney animated films just really aren't up to par. I mean, they're still good and they still have the songs and stuff, but it's just missing something. And so you're right. It's like they hit like a perfect storm of like the right animators, you know, the right executives and the right, you know, the right people doing the music. I think having a more international staff had something to do with it, maybe. And I really think Howard Ashman had a lot of important input to kind of change things around. Of course, I'm no like Disney historian. This is just like one guy's opinion, but it was really cool. And I thought it was funny how everyone was like, you got to see kind of a more intimate side of the, you got to see the animator's viewpoint of all of this. I loved all the caricatures.
Yeah. That definitely shows personality right there.
Yeah, seriously. But it was just so cool to like kind of get this kind of overview of the Disney Renaissance. I didn't realize how much they were failing at first.
Oh yeah, if they get beat out.
They moved all the animators out. They got beat out by Silence of the Lambs.
No, no, no. Silence of the Lambs is understandable. They got beat out by the Care Bears movie.
Oh, that's right. Was that the Black Cauldron?
Yes. It's this like $40 million movie beat out by the Care Bears. Like,
that's beautiful.
It's very harsh.
No wonder mass media just assumes that all of us are morons and that's why we get such ridiculous content. But because some people liked the Care Bears movie more than the Black Cauldron. And maybe that's just me being offended by it, but I don't know. That was kind of funny.
They didn't know their market also. And it's just, it was poor advertising, I'm sure. And also, that movie's really hard to get through. I mean,
yeah, the Black Cauldron has no songs.
It's so hard.
It has enough lovable characters.
Oh, brother. It's not just the songs. It's a long movie.
It was Disney's entire attitude. It was Disney's entire attitude towards animation, just in general. Like, it didn't care. And it just kind of let crappy stuff go through just because it felt like it needed to, that it was this obligation. There was no passion behind it, you know? There were obviously very, very talented people who were frustrated with the situation they were working in. You know, that's why a lot of people left and some stayed. And I'm grateful, like, you know, Ron and John, they stayed and they kind of pushed through it and they really made the Renaissance what it is. And I'm grateful for that. But the company itself needed a change. So I'm grateful. I mean, like, when you listen to Disney War, the very first half, you are such a Michael Eisner fan. He is so awesome. He did amazing things. Like, you're just cheering him on. Like, what a great guy. Like, he's really done some great business things and great things for the studio and brought it back. And that was great. And then you see him fall, and that's sad. But, you know, the big change in leadership and just attitude towards it, I mean, it shows how just your general attitude can make you a success or a failure.
It's true. And people skills, in his case.
Yeah. So what's your favorite movie of the Disney Renaissance?
Oh, that one's hard. For me, it's definitely Beauty and the Beast.
Mm-hmm.
But Lion King is really close. And, you know, Little Mermaid, like, just all those are my top three. I'll just leave it at that. Like, that's all there were. But, you know.
It's a coincidence that they're all during this time period.
Yeah.
They were all very consistently good.
Yeah, very good. Excellent.
Let's see. I'm trying to think of which one would be my favorite. I really like Beauty and the Beast. Maybe that's mine.
Mine's Aladdin, but I do like Beauty and the Beast. I like Lion King. I mean, they're all good. So, and Little Mermaid, they're all top in my
life. I'm going to change my, I'm going to say that Lion King is my favorite from the Disney Renaissance.
Yeah.
Yeah. We still have to do that one, right? We haven't done that.
I know. We need to do that one because that one's really good. Okay, so I'm going to talk about kind of where the Disney Renaissance trailed off. So Lion King, we knew, was this amazing film. It's not necessarily Broadway like all those other ones are. It is a little different. And I think that's why it was so successful, because if you kind of, I mean, as people, we like to see the same thing, like girl meets guy meets girl, they fall in love, whatever. I mean, we will watch the same type of movie over and over and over again. That's fine. But I think Disney, they just became so repetitive. It was a heroine, it was this, you know, or, you know, there was a princess involved, some sort of royalty, there are lots of big musical numbers, that it just kind of became predictable. There was like a big moment in like the second half of the Disney Renaissance that really sort of, for Michael Eisner, this was the moment where his regime went downhill and just went out of control, because he had this right-hand man named Frank Wells. And Frank Wells was the COO of the company, and he really kind of guided Michael Eisner in his decisions and kind of balanced him out. Frank Wells, in, I think, 94, 95, he died in a helicopter crash.
Yeah, he did.
And that really hurt Disney, and especially Eisner. And so after this, I mean, I don't know if this is like a turning point, but I think Pocahontas On is kind of like the second half of the Renaissance and, you know, the B team. It's still, they're really good, but they're not as good. I think Disney tries to repeat what it's done in the past, and it's just not working like it used to. So Pocahontas was expected to be this huge hit, and it wasn't. I mean, they took liberties with American history, which is fine. I mean, they changed books, endings, and stories all the time, but I mean, it was just weird. I really liked Pocahontas, but a lot of people didn't. And then, you know, they go on and they do Hunchback of Notre Dame, Mulan, and Tarzan. So each one of those,
which were good.
Yeah.
You know, not including Hunchback, but were they as good as the Renaissance?
No. Would you say they were good than any of those four movies we mentioned at the beginning? Mermaid, no. Lion King, Aladdin. Yeah.
No.
Not. And so I think this formula really had played its course, and they just weren't led as well as they used to. And we know that at this point, Katzenberg, he left. He went to DreamWorks. And Disney kind of was just floundering. Like, they were good films, and they were kind of riding off the coattails of their success. They were able to release a movie every year, and it was decently well and decently good. But just wasn't the pow and the X factor that those other movies had.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's something also. I read another book called The Outliers this last year, and I got that one off audible.com as well. I really like Audible. You guys should really check it out. but
I have books that I need to get.
Yeah, that one is a really good one. And it has a lot of different topics that it kind of goes into. Mostly it focuses on why people are great. Why are the big people, the greatest people in the world in their field, why are they where they're at? And one of the things is because of, you know, the time period in which you were born actually means a really big thing. Like, for example, it talks about like hockey players and how you can basically tell because of the system that hockey has in the guy isn't from Canada, and so obviously hockey's a big thing for them. And he says that basically you can almost always tell that NHL players are all going to have around the same birthday between January 1st and like March 15th, you know, those first couple of months, because that gives the kid enough time to get the most training possible. But anyway, the whole reason I'm bringing this in is kind of interesting how all of this started around like 1989. And it's just kind of, I find it really interesting. One of the main reasons that I think all of us are so into, you know, Disney and all of these different shows is because we were all born just a little bit before that, just enough to where we would know what was going on when it hit. And we would be able to be in this whole zone and be able to appreciate it throughout the entirety of the Disney Renaissance, which, you know, is really interesting. That was just something that came to my mind. I'm like, wow, why am I the way I am? Because I was born in 1986. I was just old enough to be able to get into it and just young enough to stay into it the whole time.
Love it.
Yeah, that's very philosophical.
Thank you.
Yeah, so, you know, close it up. The Disney Renaissance really transformed animation, not only just for Disney, but for other companies as well. It breathed life back into the medium. And, you know, if there wasn't a Disney Renaissance, I hate to say this, but animation as we know it would not be the same. Mm-mm. I don't think there'd be as many big studios. I just don't know where animation would play. Would it just be for kids on Saturday mornings? You know, I really don't know what it would be. And so this was really good. It reinvigorated the studio, and it really set a high bar for the studio. I mean, when Pocahontas didn't do well, it was like a shocker. And all those movies afterwards, they were okay, but they weren't great. And like, people still like call Disney back to this Renaissance period. Like, that was your golden years. And well, actually, no, the golden years were when Walt was around. But there's the golden years, which is the 40s and Disney. And then there's the Renaissance, which is the 90s. So can Disney have another one of these? You know, a second Renaissance? Are we in that right now? What do you guys think?
That has a lot to do with the leadership, like we were talking about before. But it also has a lot to do with the actually believe that competition had a lot to do with this whole thing. For example, like their lowest years were right when Don Bluth left, and there was finally another game in town that made them realize how bad they were and like where they were and how much they needed to step it up. So I think, and then also now we also have DreamWorks in there, Laika. There's a whole bunch of these studios that are performing really well with this same medium. And I think that it may not be a renaissance for one specific company. It may not be for Disney, but somebody will take this and take it to the next level.
Well, you can argue that Pixar took the torch.
It's true. It's very true.
95 was when Toy Story came out and blew people away. And it kind of, took on the gold standard of animation. Like, it used to be Disney, but then people, when they think, oh, it's all about Pixar, and is Pixar still like that? I think that Pixar is doing relatively well and still maybe holds the crown. I don't think DreamWorks has taken it away. Maybe some of these new and up-and-coming studios, but I don't know. It was interesting things to ponder.
Yeah.
But we'll have to ponder them another day because we
indeed
have a big discussion to talk about, which is the first film of the Disney Renaissance, The Little Mermaid.
Woohoo! This I haven't seen in years. This is wonderful.
The child is in love with a prince.
Have you lost your senses completely? He's a human. You're a mermaid.
Teenagers, you give them an inch, they swim all over you.
The time has come to return.
Under the sea. Wind is a deep, music to be.
Walt Disney Pictures invites you back to the spectacular world of The Little Mermaid.
Look at you. There's something different.
She's got legs, you idiot.
Relive the timeless classic with Flounder, Sebastian, King Triton, Ursula the Sea Witch, Prince Eric, and of course, Ariel.
Oh my gosh.
Sing with me now.
Sha-la-la-la-la-la, don't be scared. Got the moves prepared. Go on and kiss the girl. Sha-la-la-la-la-la, don't stop now. Don't try to hide it, how you wanna kiss the girl. Sha-la-la-la-la-la, float along and listen to the song.
When's it my turn? Wouldn't I love to explore that shore up above? Wandering free, wish I could be part of your world.
Isn't it fantastic?
The Little Mermaid.
I wouldn't miss it.
When was the last time we did a film from the Disney Renaissance?
Let's see. Beauty and the Beast was our first one. We did Aladdin. I think it has to be Aladdin.
Yeah,
it was Aladdin. So these are few and far between. Like, we don't do a lot of like straight up 2D animated films from Disney.
Well, it's not that we don't do them. We just haven't gotten there yet. I mean, there aren't that many fantastic ones. So we kind of got to spread them out a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
In one piece.
Otherwise, there would be nothing to look forward to.
Okay, but speaking of fantastic, like Little Mermaid, I feel so weird saying that, but I'm not really ashamed to say it. Little Mermaid rocks. Like, it's a really good film.
Yeah, oh yeah. I love Little Mermaid.
So good.
I love to think, I mean, you went from Oliver and Company to this, all thanks to Howard Ashman and Alan Menken, as we were talking about. But Howard Ashman especially, I mean, they put him on as producer as well. And I loved being able to watch the documentary, and it shows how much of a force he was in these first movies, and especially in The Little Mermaid.
Yeah, so he's awesome. I really do think that he's one of the like key factors of why this movie was so successful and the movies afterwards. So basic info about The Little Mermaid, released November 17th, 1989.
I was 1 year old.
Oh, little Mason.
Aww.
So cute.
That's how I was.
It was directed by Ron Clements and John Musker, who is, you know, the duo, the great directing duo of The Great Mouse Detective, Aladdin, Hercules, Treasure Planet, and Princess and the Frog. And they have something new that's coming out. They just went on kind of a, a exploratory field trip to the new location that their new movie is going to be set in, which people are saying is going to be kind of in the Paperman style. So that's kind of cool to see.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Won't see it for a while, but anyways. Like we said, music by Howard Ashman, Alan Menken. And they started working on it as early as 1985. So this movie like really was fine-tuned over the years to be good. It grossed $111 million domestically, an additional $99 worldwide, so $200 million. And like we were just talking about Rise of the Guardians. Rise of the Guardians has made about $300 million, and it's considered, you know, not so successful, not that great. So it's just funny how times change.
Yeah.
Our guy. Of what is good and what isn't number wise. It's just a sliding scale.
Yeah.
So this is Disney's 20th animated feature. So to put it in perspective, Tangled was its 50th. So a little over halfway. And like we mentioned, considered the beginning of the Disney Renaissance. This is the one that opened the floodgates.
Yeah. So animation wise, I'm going to talk about some of the cooler points of the animation in this film, because I really think it is a strong animated classic. Now in Waking Sleeping Beauty, they mentioned the CAPS system. So the CAPS is a digital ink and paint production system. What it does is it colors your animators' characters and layouts and stuff and whatever you want, basically, by computer instead of hand-drawn. And so they developed that back when they were really, like, they had all these deadlines and were really trying to get these movies out. And it really doesn't take away from the quality, in my opinion. It just helps it go faster. But this was the first use of CAPS. It's not like the whole thing was digital, because this was this is also the last film to have hand-painted cells. All the 2D animated Disney movies used CAPS after this one. I guess it's important to note that most of Little Mermaid was hand-drawn. Like, it had hand-painted cells. And but there were just some parts of it, mostly towards the end, that used the CAPS system, from what I understood, according to my research. But this isn't the first time they had heard of Little Mermaid.
No. So I'm going to tell the story of Little Mermaid, the original story, because this is something, like, I always knew that it was based on a fairy tale, that things were changed. But I finally went down and did some research, you know, the old Wikipedia, it's a good place, and some other places, just to see, okay, so what is the original story? So if you don't want to be spoiled, I guess, you just, like, fast forward a little bit, because I'm going to tell you what happened. So The Little Mermaid is a story by Hans Christian Andersen. It's a fairy tale, and it's kind of the same premise as the movie. You know, there's Ariel and her sisters. And in the story, you know, the sisters have this coming of age ritual, and 15 is the coming of age year in the book. And so each year, when they turn 15, they are allowed to go up to the surface and take a look at the human world. And, you know, they each do it during, you know, since they're born during different times of the year, they can go during different times, like winter, summer, stormy season, and they can tell the people down below, the mer people, what it's like. And so Ariel finally gets her chance, and she goes up, and then she sees a shipwreck. So we're seeing the similarities here between the movie. And so she goes and she rescues the prince that is, you know, drowned in the sea, and she falls in love with him. And she decides, I want to be with this guy forever. So she goes back down to the, you know, the ocean, and she tells everyone, you know, her father, Triton, you know, he doesn't really like the surface. He doesn't like people. You know, that's similarities between the real Triton in the movie. But he lets his daughters go up anyway, just because it's the way it's always been done. So when she comes back, she has this conversation with her grandma about the human soul. So this is kind of like the philosophical part. I mean, Hans Christian Andersen, there's definitely very religious undertones in his writing. So according to the story, apparently mermaids, they can live to be about 300 years old. Not too bad. But they don't have a soul. So when mermaids die, they just turn into sea foam and they just kind of like float away on the top of the ocean. And that's the end of a mermaid. And it's actually kind of sad. And so Ariel, she decides that she really wants one of these human souls. So, you know, the grandma, of course, tells her how she can get one. She needs to find a prince, have him kiss her, and then his soul would be a part of her soul. So Ariel, she goes on this journey to the witch's place. The sea witch isn't really a fan of like turning her into a human, but she does it anyway. And like the sea witch is sort of like this unbiased third party character. like the witch in Brave. Like, she's not a villain in the book, but she's not a good guy. She's just kind of there just to make the story go along. Well, so she gives Ariel this potion in exchange for Ariel's tongue. And the witch warns her that when she drinks it, it's going to be really painful. She's going to lose her tail. Like, her tail's really long, so it's going to, like, shrivel up into these legs. And it's going to be, you know, it explains it. It's going to be like a sword slicing down the middle. But when she recovers, she will have the most beautiful pair of legs ever. You know, they're going to be really enviable. People are going to like her. She'll be able to dance and walk gracefully and do all those things that humans do.
So that's where the whole body language quote comes from.
Body language.
Yeah.
So, but however, you know, as she's, since this all happened, like every step she takes is going to be like stepping on knives. So it's going to be like incredibly painful. Like, we don't really see that in the movie. So, you know, Ariel does.
Jeez.
Yeah, I know.
So Ariel, like, does it, and, you know, she drinks the potion, she goes up to the surface, but the problem is the prince doesn't fall in love with her. He's actually fallen in love with somebody else. Like, the problem was that when Ariel rescued him, you know, she wasn't there when he woke up. Instead, there was this other girl who appeared and was hovering over him when he woke up, and so he fell in love with her because he thought she was the one who had rescued him. So, you know, Ariel can't speak through all of this, and that doesn't help the situation. So, you know, as a result, the prince doesn't fall in love with her, and she realizes she's going to die and turn into seafoam at the next sunrise. So the prince and princess marry, and princess is not Ariel. It's the other Vanessa type, I guess you would say. And Little Mermaid heartbreaks. She's very disappointed. So she despairs, and thinking that death awaits her, her sisters actually realize this, and they bring her a knife that the sea witch has given them in exchange for her, for their long hair. And they say, okay, if Little Mermaid, Ariel, if you slay the prince with this knife and let his blood drip on your feet, then you will become a mermaid again, and all your suffering will end, and then you'll be able to live out your 300 years as a mermaid. Unfortunately, Ariel cannot do this. She doesn't want to kill the prince. You know, she has the chance to kill him and the princess while they're sleeping, and she doesn't want to do it. So instead, she essentially commits suicide. She throws herself into the sea, you know, right as the dawn breaks, and her body dissolves into foam. But instead of, you know, ceasing to exist like she was told, she feels the warmth of the sun. And it turns out she has been turned into a spirit, a daughter of the air, so an air spirit. So then these other daughters of the air tell her that she became like them because she strove with all her heart to gain an eternal soul. So since she had these desires to have a soul, she was rewarded and became a spirit of the air. So, you know, the way she can earn her own soul, I mean, these air spirits, they don't have souls, but they can earn it. Mm. Unlike who just don't have the chance. So she has to do good deeds for 300 years. But that's the Little Mermaid, much, much different than what we were shown in this movie.
Dang, that's, wow.
Kind of interesting. I mean, I see why they didn't do certain things. Suicide, not a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it just doesn't end well for Ariel. Like, it kind of does, but not like in the movie. Your original thoughts and recollections from the movie.
Little Mermaid was just one of those movies that was always on VHS, like, in my house. Mm-hmm. And so, now we'd watch it every once in a while, and I always enjoyed it. I thought it was cool.
Yeah, this movie was just kind of always a classic. It was one that girls like. Like, Ariel really brought sexy back for the redheads. I mean, she gave... They loved Ariel. Ariel was their favorite character. And, like, this is any Disney princess. I sort of see this similar thread that the Disney princess you like the most or you relate to the most is the one that has the same hair color as you.
It's true.
So, you know, the redheads finally had their leading lady. So yeah, you know, she's really cool. I really liked her design. I mean, she was a mermaid and we love mermaids. So this was just, it just brought kind of like the fantasy elements along with the love elements and the music. It was, you know, kind of a good trifecta there.
Yeah. Oh man, I loved this movie. You know, VHS life started at Little Mermaid. One thing that I really loved is Ariel, of course. I mean, I'm not a redhead, but I loved her because she was just great. Glenn Keane, he talks about how the moment he heard her voice, the moment he heard the song "A Part of Your World," he just was like, "I have to draw this. I have to do her." And they're like, "You don't. You've never really done anything like this. You're not really. That's not really what you've been typecast to draw." But he's like, "No, I feel it in everything that I am, that I have to draw this squirrel." And it's just really cool to think, like, his vision of what he saw is now all of our realities.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. We talked about, like, good Disney films and bad Disney films. And this one definitely stood out as when I was a kid as one of the good Disney films. I think it had a lot to do with the animation. So like Little Mermaid is like, I don't say this much, but it's like it really is an animation masterpiece. Like seriously, so much work went into this film. Like over 1 million plus total drawings. A lot of them were hand-drawn bubbles. Like all the bubbles in this film are hand-drawn. There's over 1 million of them.
Wow.
I think they outsourced some of the labor to studios overseas with the bubbles, but so like a ton of stuff. I mean, you could just pretty much have like a whole book on how much art went into this film. Like holy cow, like they really put some thought and research into this. From Triton's wrath, you know, getting all mad and like blowing up all of the stuff in her cavern. You know, there's like some really dramatic lighting there. Part of your world has like this light shaft coming down that she's like singing into, you know, and it's really cool. The storm sequence, you know, where Prince Eric, the storm comes on him, that took over a year to animate because there were so many digital. I mean, there were so many special effects used, not necessarily digital. A couple of details I noticed is that the floating hair, like they really made it look like their hair was floating because it is water, you know, and anyone who's been in water knows that your hair floats.
Yeah.
So they looked at footage of astronaut Sally Ride in Zero Gravity. That was kind of their basis.
So any girl knows, thanks to this movie, anytime you were in a pool, it was the Little Mermaid effect. Go down, bend, and you would let your hair float up like Ariel, and then you had to finish it off by coming to the surface and doing the Little Mermaid hair flip.
The whoosh-ish.
Talking about if they're a girl.
Yeah.
and then you'd always try to do the Little Mermaid. It was awesome.
Do the Little Mermaid.
I guess I can't relate, but thanks for that input. I didn't know that.
Oh, no. Yeah,
I didn't know there was an Ariel effect or a Little Mermaid effect.
Of course.
Girl cult. You didn't grow up in the 90s. Unless
girl
you
culture.
Did.
I have no clue. Yeah. And there's a lot of expression in this film, like with the animation. It starts with the fish that escapes from Eric's ship. You know, it can't talk. So it's like, goes down, looks up, realizes he's safe. And he's like, whew. And then he puts on like a more human quality, you know, because then you're in the undersea world. From that to, Ariel using her voice, they had to communicate, losing her voice, I should say. They had to communicate what she was feeling and thinking without dialogue. And so that's really cool when animators are able to do that. But yeah, those were just details I really liked. I mean, there's little stuff too, like how Sebastian dances in Under the Sea and all that stuff. There's just so much cool animation that I really can't go into it like in however long this episode is. But this movie has some like really quality animation. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, so plot. So let's just go from the beginning and talk to the end. Like we're gonna try something new here. So the very beginning.
Yeah, I always forget about the first song on Eric's ship, but this time watching, I was like, oh yeah, there's like a song like in the first 5 seconds.
Yeah, be kind of longer. If you've seen the musical, you know that it's a big, long, drawn-out song. Apparently, it was supposed to be longer.
Really?
They just cut it because they're like, yeah, we got to get into this rather than, you know, the seamen singing who we won't see again.
I know, right? I like how the Eric Grimsby thing. So Grimsby's one of my favorites. He's like so freaking funny. He's like the
so
guy who's
good.
Like, oh, Eric, I have to take care of this boy.
So, okay, so we go down to the surface and there's this really cool intro where we see, you know, the fish jumps out of the boat and goes down, and then we discover there's this big concert. And I'm not quite sure why this party or concert is happening. Is it Ariel's coming out?
It could be.
It's her musical debut.
Yeah.
So, which we know what happens. She's not there, and it's a big flounder, I guess you would say.
It flops like a flounder. I just like the little horse, the little seahorse is like, Horatio, Thelonious, Ignatius, Crustaceous, Sebastian. I never realized that was Sebastian's name. I tried to memorize it, but I had to go to Google to get it again. But yeah, that part's really funny.
I love that song too. The sisters are awesome.
I just love the sisters. I think the sisters are the coolest. They have the best names. I mean, so they have this song and they're singing their names. And let me tell you their names. We have Atina, of course, Aquata, Andrina. It's not Adrina, it's A-N, Andrina, Arista, Adela, Alana, and that's it. So she has these sisters and they're obviously older than her, and they have this big song, and Ariel, guess what? She's not there. So we go to the shipwreck, which is really scary part of the movie. Just like jump right in. But
yeah, the shipwreck and the shark. So the shark always scared me as a kid. I was such a guppy. And then we get introduced to Flounder, who's like, I don't know, he's kind of cool. Like, I just think Flounder's cool.
Do you know what's funny? In the sequel, his voice is totally like a man's voice, and it really bothered me. Just
really?
Yeah. It's like really bad. And I didn't even realize that at this point in time in the movie, he's supposed to be a kid. Like, he's supposed to be just this little kid that follows her around. But it makes sense, I guess, but it's just weird.
Yeah, seriously. It always scares me as a kid. And speaking of stuff that bothered me, like, all that for a fork? Like,
yeah.
Like, I get attacked by a shark and, like, this horrible, scary thing. And all that for a fork? Come on.
Yeah. And then Scuttle, he's probably the best out there. Like, he's so funny. Oh, such a great character.
Like, he's one of my favorite characters in this film. Because he's, like, silly, but he's not, like, goofy. He's, like, got his own, like, personality, I guess.
Yeah.
Dude, I love the way his hair looks when he, like, does the dingle hopper on his hair.
See, I got this aesthetic configuration of hair that the humans go nuts over.
I love that guy. When people would just stare at each other all day, got very boring.
Little island that he lives on. Like, apparently Ariel knows exactly where to find him, but it's in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah,
there's this old little like ship part of your ship that's stranded there, and he's something is off, you know, because he puts the anchor down so he can.
Maybe he's been out in the sun for too long.
That would make a lot of sense right there.
He's got kind of a big Z kind of thing, you know.
Yeah,
it's true. Okay, so then we go back down and we realize that Ariel realizes she's missed the concert and she's going to be in trouble. And Triton, like, I love his logic. It's like, as long as you live under my ocean, you live under my rules. It's like, well, okay, so she's always going to be living in the ocean, right? So she'll always be under his rules
until
her entire life.
Until there's another king, which who's going to be the king?
Well, you can't blame him. He doesn't have a mother's he doesn't have a wife's perspective on the thing. You know, yet another Disney single parent from the late 80s, 90s.
Well, maybe there's a merkings all around. I mean, one of the Indian Ocean, one of the Pacific Ocean. So maybe if she moved to a different ocean, she'd be okay.
Maybe.
Well, Triton is the name of one of Neptune's sons in Greek mythology. So there might be more there.
All right, we'll go with that.
So, like, Triton, that's his name. And he has this trident.
Well, he's got powers with it, but we only see a few of his powers.
Need the trident to have his powers, obviously, because that's the whole thing. Like, that's Ursula's whole shtick, that she just wants the trident. I mean, but how powerful is this trident?
And does the name follow the trident? Like, does he have another name?
It's Triton's trident.
Is it?
Yeah, Triton is a name. Trident is instrument of might.
That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. Okay, so from what I've observed in the film, he can turn mermaids human and merfolk human. You can also zap people with it.
Yeah, the zap.
Because Ursula does it. And then you can also do like, the waves obey my command, you know? You can do all that. You can make whirlpools with it. All kinds of stuff. I mean, I really think it's only limited by the holder's imagination. It could possibly create time vortices.
That would bring it all together right there.
It can create rainbows.
Yeah, there you
go.
Creates happy endings. That's what we do. I would say one of the most classic parts of this movie is definitely where she sings Part of Your World.
Yeah.
Like,
well, yeah. I mean, that's Howard Ashman. That's where he like brought his like strength into the film, because it's like the first big song, right?
Yeah, and just as he was saying in the documentary, just as this is one of those parts where at the very beginning of the play, it doesn't have to be the first song or maybe even the second song, but within the first four songs or so, there's always a point where the main protagonist female sits down on something and just sings this song, like her soliloquy of telling her story. And where you just want her to win from then on out. And
Yeah.
It was totally this song, but I couldn't believe it as we were watching the documentary, just how this song almost didn't make it as part of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because kids were bored during the test screening. There was like a kid who was like dropped his popcorn and he wanted to pick up his popcorn more than listen to the song.
Right. But
you made a good point there with the whole like female protagonists or male protagonists, whatever it is, Disney protagonists, kind of singing about what they want in mm-hmm. their life that they want to do different. You know, they actually started with Snow White because, like, her whole deal was that she just wanted a boyfriend, you know, and so she yeah. sings about that, you know, and then and Cinderella.
I'm wishing. Her voice always bugged me. I'm sorry.
Her voice is ridiculous. That's a sign of the times right there.
Yeah, it was.
And then Cinderella has her little, a couple of her songs about how much she wants to, like, give up the peasant, you know, the maid life and be, like, in a castle and stuff. So it's, and then they had a whole era where they didn't do that, and that's probably where Disney hit their kind of slump, you know what I mean?
It's because the last fairy tale that they had done before this was Sleeping Beauty, and Sleeping Beauty had the I Wonder song, which I love that song. When we do that movie, I'm definitely going to sing that one because it makes me so happy.
Seriously.
It makes me really, really happy. So, but
okay, so part of your world, how does that rank to you? Where does that rank in as far as like Disney songs?
Let me see. I don't know. Like, if you were to do Aladdin, you know, he's got his little part, Riff Raff Street Rat. I don't buy that. But that's not really much of a song, because they got rid of his original one. But, and then Hercules has Where I Belong. That one's a good one. This is a difficult question. Does Tarzan have one?
Tarzan, it doesn't have songs that the characters sing. It just has kind of music videos by Phil Collins, you know? It was that era.
That's right.
But the one that was right next to it was Mulan, and they sing all the time.
Yeah.
So
that one's a really
Tarzan
good one.
Tarzan had a more serious tone. Anyway, we digress.
But I would say Mulan, that one was one of my favorites. But I think of all time, Sleeping Beauty. That one makes me really super happy. So yeah. I'm going to go with that one.
Part of Your World's a good song, because it's kind of unique, because she doesn't really know, because she has to kind of like remember her like land lessons, you know, like what's a street, what's a fire.
Uh-huh.
And she's got all her cool artifacts. I thought it was cool. There's really dramatic lighting in the song, and the animation's really cool. I don't know, this was Glenn Keane, wasn't it, who animated Ariel?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so he did a terrific job kind of showing her her emotion and kind of her like really wanting to be out there.
Oh yeah, that one part where she like goes up to the hole in the top of the grotto, it's like that is the most iconic picture of this whole movie, I believe. It's just every girl specifically will know that scene.
Yeah, there's that one, and then where she sings her little part again after saving Eric, and she kind of pushes herself up on the rock. And is, like, you know what I'm talking about? You know
Yeah.
That's like the number one scene, I think.
Yeah, that's such an iconic scene. And it just always reminds me of, well, there was this one time, Mason, where I was trying to put together my own music video for like this Spanish song that I was singing.
Really? That doesn't surprise me at all.
I know. Anyway, so I go to Morgan. I'm like, Morgan, come on and help me make this video. And so we like walk around my house trying to find these things, any place to do it. And there's this one lake that we have, and it's got this big giant rock in the middle. And we're like, oh, let's get on that and be the Little Mermaid rock. It didn't quite ever work out, though, and that always made me so sad. I was like, oh, that would have been epic had I been able to throw in a Little Mermaid rock into a music video. It'd be fantastic.
Hey, there's still time.
I bet there's parody YouTube videos of that song where she's like, part of your world. It's like, I bet they do that somehow.
They've got to. If not now, or if not yet, they will someday.
I think the next iconic scene is when she like does her like dramatic like coming up for air after getting her legs.
Yes.
And it's like slightly, but it's okay. It's all silhouette. But I think those are the three most iconic kind of images from the film.
It all has
to do with all the drama and kind of the longing that Ariel has, and so Glenn Keane did a really good job of communicating that.
Yeah. Do you know what's funny? Now that you're talking about that, I remember right when Flotsam and Jetsam come up at the very like, oh, yeah. Right when she's on the rock looking over at Eric as he starts walking away with Grimsby. If you look at the animation, you can totally tell it was not Glyn Keane that was drawing her, because it is so off model. She looks like she's 12, you know, she like just really weird looking, but like you don't even really notice nor really care, but you do, and it's just funny.
Yeah, I love it when she like surfaces because she sees the fireworks, and like me and Shannon were watching this and we were like, you know, she sees it and it's just a ship and there's all these fireworks and we're like, oh great, she's like stumbled upon the ending of Peter Pan all of a sudden. It's going to start flying up into the sky. Think of a wonderful thought.
Any happy little thought.
I know. And the guy's like, you know, I've seen that ship long ago. When I was very young. I was like, no, Ariel, get out of there. Wrong movie.
It's like when they had those Stitch, the Lilo and Stitch commercials, like he's like jumping into all of the other movies.
Did he ever stumble into Little Mermaid?
He did. He did stumble into Little Mermaid, I believe.
All I saw was the Aladdin ones and the, you know, the Beast, the Beauty and the Beast one.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so here's my big question, Prince Eric. Where does Eric fall on the Disney Prince hotness scale?
He's pretty high up there. I'll be honest.
He's pretty high up there.
Yeah.
So I would give Eric, I don't know, a 7 or an 8. There's nothing really special about him. You know, he has that dark, good-looking hair. You know, if they have hair, that's a good thing. I must agree. But still, the fact that it's there is good. And I don't know. Overall, his look is like pretty bland, but kind of appealing. So that's why I'm like on the fence about him. For me, it's all about Aladdin and Philip. But
well, Aladdin has skills, you know. And Philip, he's an okay sword fighter, you know, and he's good with horses. But it's like Eric, all he knows how to do is like throw parties for himself, you know?
This is true.
Although he's a pretty good flute player.
The one playing the snarflack.
I don't know. He looks kind of hairy and slobbery.
No, I always thought he was good looking. Like I'm like, Eric is a good looking prince. I'll give him that. But yeah, I'm with Morgan.
You know, he's got that blue eye, black hair thing, you know. I bet he dyes his hair.
Blonde.
Could be a toupee, and even for all I know.
Hey, it was in the time period.
Who knows? I asked the same question in my studio class at A&M.
Oh yeah.
You know, there's a bunch of like freshman sophomore girls there who love Disney. And I was like, okay, attention everyone, Eric on Little Mermaid, how hot is he? And they're like, oh, he's so hot. The dark hair. He's not much of personality, but he's so good looking. And I was like, okay, is he like the hottest? And they're like, yeah, he's the hottest. And they're like, okay, who's hottest? Eric or Flynn Rider? Yeah, Flynn Rider. So
what?
Well, don't ask my opinion on it, but that's the consensus I got. It was like Eric until you mentioned Flynn Rider.
I'll be honest. The dark hair has never really, I don't know, it's never really been my thing. It's all about Philip. Like,
besides the generals, you know, the mantagonist on Mulan, there aren't a lot of dark haired Disney guys.
It's true. It's true.
Well, there's Aladdin.
Yeah, Aladdin is pretty good looking too, though. I'll be honest with that one.
I
don't know. You know, you never see Eric on the like the top five, you know, Disney guys. I don't know.
He has the whole package.
He does.
You know, he saves her. He kind of woos her. He's actually involved in this relationship. Yet he's kind of forgotten, at least in my mind. So.
And then Ariel just falls in love with him in like 5 seconds. You know, classic Disney love story.
Hey, and I think we've all been there, though.
Yeah. Well, it took her like 5 seconds. It took Cody Maverick on Surf's Up like 2 seconds to fall in love with Lonnie.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm in love. But that doesn't last long because this like crazy storm comes up. The animation for which and the special effects took about more than a year to complete. So this is like, you know, if this was Star Wars, it'd be the pod racing sequence. But, and it's, you know, there's all this drama. You know, I love that part where Eric, like, grabs the wheel and he, like, turns it and it's, like, lightning striking and it's so dramatic. And then it's always the powder kegs. Why do they need a huge room that's, like, got the door, like, all, like, swinging open? Powder kegs. You know? Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, this film. Why is it always the powder keg? So lightning strikes and causes a fire that just slowly inches to the powder room. I know. it's so like quintessential, you know. But anyway, it blows up and she saves Eric, and then I like how she kind of sings a little bit of Part of Your World, you know. It's mm-hmm. very Broadway, you know, repeating that musical motif. So, and then, you know, Sebastian tries to convince her the human world is a mess.
Life under the sea is better than anything they got up there.
I know.
I love that song. Man, that is so Howard Ashman.
Under the Sea is probably one of the greatest, you know, whenever you see like someone's YouTube playlist or like a Groove Chart playlist of best top, you know, top 20, top 40 Disney songs, this is one of them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think most of the songs in this film can qualify, but this one kind of takes the cake. This is like the song of the film.
I mean, you think it's Part of Your World, but then you think again, and it's really Under the Sea. I think didn't this one win the Oscar?
I'm pretty sure it did, because this one is fun.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this one's fun. Like, Howard Ashman, like, it's like the perfect blend of, like, cheesiness, but also, like, really, like, fun kind of lyrics, you know?
Uh-huh.
If you read through it, it's just a tongue twister, the entire thing. I'm like...
When he's going through that fast part, the lute, play the flute, the da 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 da,
right, right.
You know?
The sound was sharp, the bass, play the brass, da-da-da-da-da, the Duke of Soul.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that fluke. And then the black fish she sings, she's like... I didn't get that until, like... 2 years ago, last time I saw it. And people say this film is racist, but I just love it. It's like really funny.
I love at the end of the song, you know, it's like the big Broadway number where they're all like pointing to her, they're like, ha! And then they realize she's gone, and then like the fish that have joined in on this party, they just sort of indifferently float away.
Like, let's go to Chuck-O-Rama.
Yeah.
I know, ain't no thing. And then Ariel gets whisked off to like find her conveniently placed and intact life-size Eric statue.
Yeah, how in the world did Flander get that statue into the cave?
That's the big question, isn't it?
That's my question.
Did it just magically fall in there?
Yeah, and then I always think, well, did it go through that hole in the top? But what?
The goof section for IMDb, it actually says that the hole is too small to fit the statue.
Right.
Because Ariel could barely fit through it when she's singing Part of Your World.
Right.
Unless she magically, you know, engorged herself in size during the, you know, some sort of weird space vortex that made her larger or made the hole smaller.
No.
Or maybe there are multiple holes. We don't know how many holes are in her grotto.
That's true. That's true. But here's the other thing. Maybe.
I don't want to start panicking here. a Disney fan panic, but there could have been more than one hole in her grotto.
It's true.
We don't know how deep it goes, folks.
I think that Flounder is actually in with the mob of the sea.
Oh, now you're going. You're taking my conspiracy.
I'm doing all I can here.
Who knows? There might have been a ring of mischievous statue. They might have sold it to Flounder. You know, there are some pretty fast fish out there and pretty strong fish.
Oh, my.
And they could have just grabbed the statue, and Flounder could have been like, hey, I need that statue. And they'd be like, well, it's going to cost you 35 clams.
Oh, I think now we're switching into like Shark Tale. That's where...
Yeah, you're right. We're getting into the DreamWorks side.
Yeah, let's go back a few years.
Mayday. She doesn't get to enjoy her Eric statue for long, whether or not Flounder acquired it off the fish black market. I love how Sebastian's like, keep your cool, Sebastian. We can get through this. They're like, Sebastian?
Yes! Yes, sir.
So what did y'all think about the whole dramatic scene where Triton comes in and he's like, I tried being reasonable, you know, and he's like, but now I must use my trident powers, and he like zaps everything.
Daddy, don't I love him? Daddy, I love him!
You know how she does that?
Yes.
I have tried to be a reasonable merman.
Merman. Oh, I knew he was a merman.
Yeah.
Those crazy mermans.
Have you lost your senses completely? She's a human. You're a merman.
Even comic book guy knows that that's not going to work out.
You're from two different worlds. That reminds me of a letter I got from Morgan once, and she sent a clipping from a Ratatouille coloring book.
Oh,
that
yeah.
That was Remy's dad, but she like took a Sharpie and put Triton's crown and put his trident in his hands.
Oh.
And she put a little talk bubble. Like, don't go near humans. They're evil. Barbarians. Jack, they're not barbarians.
Some of my finest work right there.
I need to dig that up.
I think Triad, he has some major rage issues. Like, really, was it necessary to, like, ruin all her stuff and major destroy rage. Her grotto?
There were a few priceless paintings up there.
Yeah. Apparently he hates humans, obviously, we know, and did not care about the damage he caused. But, I mean, completely inconsiderate of his daughter, of anything that she could value. But, I mean, I understand his reasoning. Like, he doesn't want any remnants of the human world because they're savage man, you know, fish eaters.
They're savage harpooning fish eaters.
Ah, yes, yes.
Yeah, apparently the only human Triton ever came into contact with was Cat and Ahab. That's what this sounding like. Well, how many humans have you met, Daddy? Well, there's just this one. You kept going after this big white whale, and that's all I need to know about humans.
Rock on.
You know this is a good podcast when you can talk about Captain Ahab in there.
I don't know. And then there's really no, like, low point where it's like, well, your major character flaw got you at this low point. It's just because bad things keep happening to Ariel. And then Flotsam and Jetsam show up, and I think they have the creepiest voices.
They do.
So creepy.
They do.
I thought they sounded like Ursula, but it's actually a different different voice actor for them.
Uh-huh. It's like, yes?
Yes?
Wait. And
she goes off to the sea witch.
No, she's a demon. She's a monster.
She's a demon.
Why don't you tell my father? You're good at that.
That was such a big dig. Oh.
I
heard that. I was like, ooh, she got you.
Yeah, she stopped him. Come on.
I know, and it worked. It was a bluff because she's like, why don't you tell my father? And then he, like, doesn't tell his father.
You know? I know, big character moment for him.
I know. Thanks, Sebastian, for, like, causing this huge conflict.
At the time when he should have told anybody, it should have been this point.
Seriously, do you think this movie has a message about, like, child supervision? How old is she? 16? She's got, like, the whole dang ocean she can just go around in. And this is when Triton believes that she should have adult supervision?
Yeah.
Constant supervision. Constant. Anyway.
Okay, so she comes and she meets Ursula, who is not like a mermaid because she's actually half octopus. And,
yeah, kind of for us.
I just always accepted her for what she was. So I finally decided to dig into Wikipedia or, you know, creature Wikipedia, whatever, to discover exactly, like, okay, was she made up or is this a real creature? And of course, you know, like every half human, half animal hybrid, there is one of everything. And this is a real creature. She is known as a Cicalia, which is a mermaid like human octopus hybrid. And so I'm just going to read you these little, notes I learned. They travel on land short distances by use of their tentacles, and some often refer to them as witches of the sea, regardless of gender. So I think that's kind of cool that that's why, you know, she's known as the sea witch, because typically this sort of creature is the witches of the sea. It just, like, talked about these Cicalias, how they're, like, a bit more promiscuous than mermaids. And it just, like, talked about, like, all their different breeding habits and their litters and stuff, and I just thought I just got a big kick out of it. So.
More promiscuous. I don't know how that works. She's the only one in the movies wearing a one piece.
Yeah, but she has body language.
See, the men up there, they don't like a lot of blabber.
Seriously, I love Ursula. She's one of my favorite characters of all time.
She's good.
Like, she's right up there with Jafar as far as badness.
One of the quotes that I always quote is when she's like, come in, darling. We mustn't look in doorways. It's rude. One might question your upbringing.
I know.
I always do that one. It's fun.
Something I learned recently, or something I've been thinking about, actually. So Ursula was modeled after a drag queen. Obvious.
Right.
Have you ever heard that theory that, like, filmmakers, they, like, not just at Disney, but they kind of like to make their villains kind of, what's the term? Sexually deviant or ambiguous, you know? It's like, they, if it's a guy, they kind of act femmy, or they are femmy, or if it's a girl, I don't want to get too offensive here, but, like, let's see, Skyfall, Did you guys see that one?
Yes.
The Mr. Silva, the bad guy, you know, deviant, blatantly deviant. And the theory out there is that filmmakers do that regardless of how, like, you know, open-minded our society is. And they do that to make audiences uncomfortable. I'm not trying to spark like a debate here, but it happens sometimes. Like Scar, you know, he was kind of a more effeminate looking lion, you know. He kind of had that.
Yeah.
I can see that. Yeah.
Hades was all man. He was just kind of crazy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, but he was kind of a fast talker. He would call guys like babe. He would say like babe or like dude or whatever. And he would say that to everyone. You know, I don't know if that has anything to do with it. But yeah, she's definitely got like a grotesqueness just because she's like, she just throws her weight around everywhere and she's like big and she's like in your face and very, you know, melodramatic and stuff. But I don't know. Have y'all noticed that?
Not since you told me that, but now that you're mentioning it, I can definitely see it.
Yeah. And so I don't know if we were supposed to be uncomfortable with Ursula. I think my personal feelings is that she's one of those fun Disney villains that you like. They're like horrifying, you know, they're evil, but at the same time, they're like really funny.
Yeah.
You know, Jafar is one of them. They're entertaining villains.
Yeah. Though they have to have a little
bit. It's not like cover your eyes and you're like, no, no more. You know, you're like, oh, sweet. I love this.
Typically punny.
A villain. She's got an amazing villain song too.
I know. I love it. It kind of introduces Ursula's like message. Hey, Ariel, you don't need your voice. Boys like girls who shut their mouths. All you have to do is be hot, you know?
Yeah.
Body language. And then all she has to do is kiss him. Not just any kiss, but the kiss of true love.
With the heart and the
crown.
The
on
crown.
Top of it.
Yeah. Like, yeah. It's got to be the prince and it's got to be true love. Okay.
Got it. Check, check, check.
Check,
and,
check.
Oh, yeah. By sunset of the third day. Check.
Right.
There's always some sort of third day. There's always a time limit on this
magic. Of course, otherwise it'll just go on forever. I mean, you got the beast with his flower. You have this with the third day. Well, is that it?
Time is a strange thing, to quote Dumbledore. But Triton can turn Ariel back into a human, and apparently it's indefinite.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Well, because his powers are on...
Do we know that?
His powers are on definition of they're good. You know, good powers, right? And she's the evil side, so well, evil...
For all we know, Triton conjured up that storm that almost killed Eric.
Who knows? You're right.
No, we don't know. But, you know, with the spectrum that's given to us in the movie, he's the good guy, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
And so she signs a contract. I thought that was cool to see Ariel's signature.
Yeah, yeah. Ariel. What I don't understand about that contract is, like, how is that contract legal? Like, she comes back and is like, no, the contract is legal and is binding and unbreakable for even you. I'm like, how is it legal? She's underage.
Yeah, he's the king of the... She's underage and he's the king of the ocean.
What does that say?
Apparently the sea constitution is pretty strong.
I guess.
But, you know, if only. But, but yeah, she's 16 years old, so she doesn't need a legal contract. Doesn't she have to have a guardian sign it?
I don't know. What
Sebastian could have signed it for her.
Well, but then again, we're at the time period again, so...
Also, what I don't get is why does she tell Ursula that she doesn't have anything to pay her with? She's the princess of the ocean, you know?
Well, she really doesn't have any place to hide her seashell, so...
Well, it was like Jasmine had no need for money.
Right.
Ariel, it's like, meh, money, what's that?
Everything that I need to eat is all around me.
Oh, gosh. I know, she like, get gross fangs like the merfolk on Harry Potter.
Oh, gross.
I'd like to see kind of a more naturalistic Little Mermaid, you know? I want some fish to actually die, you know? But anyway, and this starts the whole second half of the film.
Mm-hmm.
We get a few awkward shots of Ariel, you know, kicking around, and then she finally makes it up. Boy, she had to swim a long way. You got to hand it to her for just now getting legs.
Yeah,
you know,
that's probably why she was able to stand up so fast, because she just swam the entire ocean.
I don't know, but when she pops up and you see Eric's castle, his castle is amazing.
I love his castle.
Like, beautiful seaside castle, and just the waves are crashing up against it, and he has his own private beach. Oh, that, I like that.
And I don't know, it kind of looks a little bit French, I guess. But I don't know. It's just so pretty.
Well, and no, I think it is because when she's on land and they go on that big adventure through the town, like she ends up with like flowers, a baguette, like a French
hat.
Yeah,
that's true. That's true. All right.
Yeah. So, yeah.
France it is. Whoa. Hold on. I want to talk about something really quick. Oh, you're okay. Talking about Kiss the Girl? I want to talk about before Kiss the Girl, the working ladies. It's like one of my favorite quotes.
Oh, yeah. We kind of switched that around.
Okay, so Ariel, she gets taken in by Prince Eric, and she goes inside, and she has this epic bubble bath. Like, I was always really
epic bubble bath.
Because the bubbles, not only are they all fluffy and bubbly and foamy in the water, but they're, like, floating around her.
Yes.
Yeah, that's never happened to me.
No.
I've never been able to replicate that bubble bath. That
you're probably not the only, like, girl to have that complaint.
She's in.
Of course not. I have that same complaint.
Yeah, you're probably not the only one to have that complaint. That's pretty good. I'll just get this washed.
I love that part because so Sebastian, he kind of gets stuck in the clothes, and I love the conversation with the working ladies.
Oh, like, yeah. How does it go?
The first lady, she's like, well, you must have heard about this girl. Well, Gretchen says, and blah, 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 and then she keeps going, and he's like, and she's like, Madame, please. Anyways, and then I just love the very end. There's another girl. She's like, not my idea of a princess. If Eric's looking for a girl, I know a couple of highly available ones right here. It's like,
that's pretty funny.
I love that conversation. It's great.
A little glimpse into castle life.
It kind of reminds me of Downton Abbey. I just watched that this last week.
Abbey?
Oh, okay.
I just saw it on Netflix. You can get a free month of Netflix if you sign up through Rotoscopers.
Yeah, you can. You totally can. Watch episodes on through our Amazon affiliate link.
Exactly.
How many more plugs can we do? Amazon.
This is kind of a My Fair Lady part of the film, because he kind of picks her up, she shook her up, she turned her around, you know?
What is that?
You know, it's that song, Don't You Want Me, Baby.
Oh, my God.
You know, you're working as a waitress at a
cocktail. Yeah, that's true. That much is true.
A Disney princess under the ocean. Never mind. So she kind of, like, gets used to being human.
Yeah, and, like, I never understood if he's actually interested in her at any point during this. Because he takes her to dinner, and she's wearing that... Okay, she's wearing the pink dress. Because
remember, folks, she can't talk, and he remembered her singing, so he does not think that's the same girl.
Yes.
Of course not.
So, I don't know if he's necessarily falling in love with her at this point, or... Well, definitely not at this point. He's just kind of being nice to her and inviting her to dinner, but there is the section where he's, like, Grimsey's talking, and Eric's just kind of staring at Ariel. I don't know, that's a bit interesting. And then they go on the big, amazing ride through the city. Which I love the music that way.
Like, that's
an awesome, just instrumental part.
There's a tour of my kingdom that takes all of one afternoon. It's very Tangled, you know?
Uh-huh.
He, like, shows her around. She, like, you know, figures everything out. And it's kind of cool because you can see similarities between her and Rapunzel, kind of. Because, they're both 16, right?
Yeah.
Wait, no, she's 16? No, Rapunzel's 18.
Yeah.
Yeah, to bump up the age. They probably got too many complaints.
Finally learned.
No kidding. But it's very Edward Scissorhands, you know, the second half of the movie where she kind of has to strike out on her own in this kind of weird environment. They make it a funny thing, you know, not like a tragic thing, because she takes the Grimsby snarf hat. Why did he give it to her anyway? Oh, 16-year-old girl, you want to smoke my pipe? No problem.
Hey, this is a different time. I mean, girls got married at age 12. You know, they were smoking by the time they were 15.
Sounds like Florida. But anyway. So Kiss the Girl, how does that rank? I like Kiss the Girl. I think it's cool. It's got that Sebastian personality in it. Like, they obviously, like...
They almost cut this song out of the movie, too. Did you know that?
Really? No.
Okay, yeah. Who were their test audience? Five-year-old boys?
I don't know. But they almost cut this one out, and I got that one from Disney War. They were talking about all the different things that was happening during this movie, and that was one of the other ones that they almost cut out.
Huh. Where can I read Disney War?
You can...
I'm just curious.
Well, if you'd like,
you know, if only there were like text files that you could download from the internet and that could be your books. You could, you know,
you could do that. You know, you could go straight and, or you could just go to audible.com and you can listen to the whole Disney War.
Oh, you can?
Yeah.
Oh
my gosh, that's so convenient. Right here on my Kindle.
Hey, I listen to it on my phone. It's great.
This is turning into that part of Wayne's World, the movie, where they're like not they're talking about product placement.
It's totally true. Oh, it's awesome. Apparently, we can be bought.
I think this is the name of our episode. Product placement book galore.
Now with more product placement. Well, okay. So I just want to bring up one little point. So I've been talking to, you know, I talk to people in my studio all the time because we're like,
you talk to people? Nice.
You talk to, oh, good job.
I'm so proud of you, Mason.
Okay, I just not got into this thing. You can talk to people.
I can talk. I can sing.
Talk to me, baby.
Dr. Zaius.
Anyways, that's Simpsons / yeah.
Everything else rolled in.
Okay, keep going.
So at first, you know, the superficial guy in me is like, cape, flute, outfit combo, you know, when he's like all when he's all melancholy about Flotsam and Jetsam, you know, their kiss being ruined, you know, so he gets on his emo clothes, his cape, you know, starts playing the flute, you know, and Grimsby's like, well, why don't you blah blah blah, you know, that's not just him being, you know, he like throws the flute, but at first I thought that was out of, yeah, made like this cool noise.
Yeah, I love that noise.
I thought that was out of pure frustration, but you know what he's doing, he's saying, you know, to heck with finding my dream girl, I like Ariel, and you know, and so it's actually kind of a cool moment because he's actually decided that he's gonna fall in love with Ariel even though he still hasn't found his magic singing lady.
Really?
You know?
It's,
yeah, that's what this girl
that.
Was talking to me about in my studio, and
that makes sense.
I was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. Like, it's not as like, oh, Eric's like throwing a tantrum. It's like he's like, you know, to heck with all this and the music, you know, if Ariel can't talk, I can still fall in love with her, you know.
I love her. I'm going to marry her. We'll be married in the morning.
And I know who should ruin the day. You know, that was close. Too close. And then, you know, enter Vanessa. Oh, my gosh. Dude, she's hotter than Ariel. I don't care what you guys think.
Ooh,
really?
Fighting words. Well, yeah, she is, but she looks a lot older. Like, to me, she looks, I mean, Ariel's clearly a teenager, while Vanessa is clearly
A woman.
Tis a woman! Oh, yeah, you're right. I'd much rather take the 16-year-old. That's right. Vanessa's way too old. Oh, yeah, different times. But yeah, she totally ruins everything. And boy, does she have an effect on Eric. He's like, we ought to be married in the morning.
Well, like, and then it's like the little smoke thing goes on his eyes. It's like, oh, it starts
that's
glowing.
That's a short engagement. Was this guy from Bountiful or something?
Well, the funny thing is, like, so yeah, I think it's funny because Grimsy's like, really? Like, are you sure? And he's like, no, we will be married in the morning. Like, okay.
Yeah,
well,
Grimsy's not much of an advisor. He's more of a like, okay, I'll just do whatever you want.
Man.
Yeah,
well, it's at this point, it's like, what do I say? Like, all right, you've found
like
her, I guess.
The wedding boat leaves at sunset.
At sunset. Yeah, and so Ariel has to, like, swim up there. I love Vanessa's evil song, you know, where she, you know, the villain always gives himself, herself away, you know.
Yeah,
she sings her little, my beautiful design.
And I'll catch that little mermaid in the ocean.
Little mermaid.
Mine.
It's kind of cool because that's Jodie Benson singing it, you know, because it's Ariel.
Yeah.
With a stolen set of pipes. I was flying. Of course I was flying. And I saw the watch, the witch.
Who was watching in a mirror.
Oh, yeah, it's awesome. And this is the part where the pacing of the film just kind of gets kind of crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Everything starts happening so quick.
Kind of Twilight-esque.
I don't know. I've never seen it. But I'm not a loser.
Hey.
Hey, look here. Did y'all notice that the king and the Grand Duke from Cinderella are on that boat?
They are?
I won't. I saw it on a BuzzFeed article. If you have to pause it at just the right moment, because it's like one of the parts where like she turns back into Ursula and she does her like creepy like hand walk.
Oh,
it's so creepy. But she brushes past the king and the Grand Duke from Cinderella. They're in different outfits.
Huh.
But it's them.
They just used old cells.
Yeah, either they use old character models or this takes place in the same universe. Just saying.
That would be a cool universe.
The folks back home can make their own conclusions, but I just thought that was cool, and I never guessed that until I actually saw it. You know, I bet there are people that go frame by frame in these movies.
There are.
They want to catch the Easter eggs.
I love those Easter eggs. And then Ursula manages to get Triton's trident.
The apparently is the source of all power. Oh, yeah. So I totally love that. Like little shriveled things. I don't know what they are. Are they worms? Or they, I don't know. Shriveled
they call them, are hilarious. They call them polyps online.
Really? Okay, well, Triton polyp is hilarious.
Yeah.
His beard, awesome.
It's not even a beard. It's just a really long mustache, isn't it?
Okay. It's a beardish mustache. I don't know. It's pathetic, whatever it is.
Nonetheless, it's cute. But sad, so it leads into this big
stay episode. That way.
So Eric comes and he like throws that thing at Ursula, and this is when it all starts, you know, going down. Ursula turns giant, and of course she has her giant booming androgynous voice, which is
the ocean.
And this is one of the more explicit
graphic
deaths. Yeah, graphic. I mean, she gets stabbed with the mast or with
that's true.
She gets like staked by a sunken ship pointy. You know, it's not your typical Disney villain death where they like fall and it's like a good clean death, you know. It's like
no, this is like lightning and you know,
gored by a freaking thing.
And like it's electrocuted and she's just like rah, it's crazy, man.
And she just kind of turns into bones and nastiness and stuff.
So here's one, you know, right at that point in time when like the trident goes down and it turns all of those other, you know, I guess polyps, I guess they are, back into mermaids. It always goes through my head of like, now all the poor decision makers are back in the society. Wasn't it better off with them in?
I know. Now all the people who made deals with the devil are like back on the street, you know.
Like it's just so funny as you watch them like all come out like, oh,
this is great.
We're back. And now we can, what? I'm like, what did you guys do? Like,
this is great. Now we can go home and finish the Vampire Diaries. So.
Yeah. Have you ever wondered, like, what do their families think of them? It's like, oh, now you've been gone for about like 4 years. Now you're back. What happened?
You know, you weren't even that overweight and you had to go to the Sea Witch and look what happened. see where extreme dieting gets you.
So, okay, so you know when Ariel turns back into a human, you know, finally Triton sees her way and he just wants to get her, he wants to give her what she wants. I love the part when puts his trident in the water, it turns Ariel into, you know, she gets eggs, she looks down and she's so excited.
Da-da.
He looks back at him to say, and he just has this drunk look on his face. It's like, ooh.
Like bouncing in the water, but his, like, one of his eyes is all cockeyed. And,
like, animated that, but I don't think it was Andreas Deja.
Go home, Triton. You're drunk.
Hey, apparently he had to get a few beers in him before he had the courage to turn Ariel into a human.
Seriously, man. Like, I don't know. I hope there's not, like, the little, you know, the in-betweener that drew that who's, like, crying right now. But he just looks drunk. He just looks like...
Awesome.
Either he's just really... I don't know. Never mind. But, but yeah, that's pretty funny.
Oh man,
it's a cool ending. It's very abrupt. You know, the pacing of this film is this part is different from the other parts of the film. You know, and you get the like, ha ha ha, love conquers all. You know,
and then to end it out with the Disney chorus, which like hasn't been used since Sleeping Beauty, anyway.
Oh yeah,
it's like
when I watched it this time around, I literally had goosebumps because it was so exciting to me. I just the Disney chorus is just very Disney and a great way to end the movie.
Yeah.
For, you know, a renaissance, it's bringing it back, it's bringing fresh life into it, you know. So there were definitely a lot of elements that were new, but I kind of like those little old school touches here and there.
Yeah
I also really like that the climax to this, like, it's like really quick. Ursula's killed, Eric washes up on shore, Ariel turns into human, wedding, rainbow, the end.
Dolphins jumping out saying yay.
I mean, although I do have a conundrum, like I never quite understood, so is the pact between humans and merpeople, or is that done? Like, do now we all know, hey, mermaids exist and they're our buddies? They came to, you know, Ariel and Eric's wedding, if you remember.
Yeah, well, I think that also goes back to the next, like the sequel that they do.
Yeah,
like, there's something happens, oh, they come up with some weird reason as to why. It seems very contrived, but you know, they come up with something as to why they no longer can talk about mer people anymore.
Well, there's a sea witch after her.
Yeah, named Ursula's
named
sister
Morgana.
Ooh. Morgana.
Morgana being the most evil name anyone could think of. You know, it was actually voiced by the same person who did Ursula.
Is it really?
Yeah, awesome. You know, there's a lot of the original voices in Return to the Sea.
Yeah.
It's the same Ariel, same Sebastian, same Scuttle, Carlotta, even Luis the Chef. He's in it. Why did they bring him back?
Hey, if it works.
Hey, he has the best song through the whole thing. I mean, all of these other songs are great, but you cannot be just a shameless...
Gotta love the shameless mockery of the French.
Exactly.
It always works.
Le poisson, I love le poisson. Love to chop and to serve them with fish. Oh, my favorite is this. Le poisson, hee hee hee, ha ha ha.
Lever, I hack them in two.
Yeah, it's just like, you can't get better than that. It's amazing.
Soutolo, I missed one. I just like when Sebastian makes a noise and he notices and he's like, he's like,
that is this.
No.
Oh.
And then he tries to kill Sebastian on the boat. Like, what a vindictive little dude.
Oh, that's the French. No, I'm kidding. Oh, I love it.
So Little Mermaid has spawned, pun intended, a few sequels and spinoffs. There's a Little Mermaid TV series. I remember seeing that. I remember there was a song called Harmony on one of the sing-along VHSs.
I had the videos.
Harmony. You know that one?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Together we'll sing in
live
harmony.
In harmony. Yeah.
You know, that is one
and,
of the
and everybody's like looking around and they're like, okay, Sebastian does it so much better, Ariel.
Yeah, I definitely remember the TV show, but I don't feel like it was on very long. I don't think it was part of the Disney Afternoon, if I remember correctly. And then it went to
you know,
cable,
they had a few
and so
those.
Once
they
it went to cable.
Oh yeah, don't even touch it. But they had some of that. They had all those movies had shows.
Yeah, they did.
Hercules, Emperor's New Groove had like a few of them. Okay, so did you guys see Little Mermaid 2 and or The Little Mermaid Ariel's Beginning?
Yes.
Well, because I made an effort to see all of the crappy sequels just so I could, you know, have something to make fun of and actually know what I'm talking about instead of just being kind of ignorant.
Yeah.
So yes, I did see that once. And Ariel's Beginning I've seen once. And I don't think I'd see it again.
I think I need to see him again just so I can make fun of him properly.
So what's the deal with Ariel's Beginning? Like, Triton bans music because of something to do with Ariel's mom.
Yeah.
You know, a grief-stricken Triton, you know.
It's because that's how she died. She had this, like, music box, and, like, she loved to sing. Oh, yeah, it was because,
and,
like...
And then it switched to Skrillex one day, and it just killed her. It just blew her brains out. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, so I think Ariel's Beginning is a lot better than Little Mermaid 2. I think Little Mermaid 2 is, like, embarrassing. It's about Ariel's daughter.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, Melody.
Uh-huh. She wants-
get it?
Melody.
Get it, music, Melody?
Melody can't know about mer people or anything. Oh, man. I only remember is the preview for that one. She's like, and you know what? Sometimes I pretend I have fins.
Oh, no.
It's like burned into my brain. I'm like, oh, get it out. Get it out.
So you're saying Ariel's Beginning had like a better story?
Yeah, better story. I thought
it's a little, at least a little original, but I'm like...
Part of the fact that the villain is another octopus lady.
Oh, really? There's another octopus lady?
Yeah, hey. It's another former advisor. Like, it's the fact that it's the same thing they're rehashing makes it bad.
Yeah.
But the only thing I really liked about that is because you got to see more of the sisters. And I love the sisters because they're pretty and they're cute and they're fun.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Then they also had the Broadway musical. You know, this is during that time period where everything was going to Broadway. And right when they ended Beauty and the Beast, they put out this one. But the problem was Beauty and the Beast lasted forever. And anytime Beauty and the Beast comes around touring, I love going to see that one. They did The Little Mermaid and it was going to be great. I wasn't there when they finally came out, but I really wanted to see it. But it only lasted about 8 months. So I was like, oh, sad.
Yeah. They had a bunch of new songs, and I thought it was kind of odd. I mean, they were on roller skates, which I don't know. I didn't look to see what the reception was towards that, but that's how they were supposed to mimic the feeling of floating and moving on water, I guess.
Yeah.
Different.
Did they do like a Disney on Ice thing?
They might have. Well, they probably just took all those old costumes and threw them in Disney on Ice again.
And the same skaters.
Yeah.
Hey, we got a gig for you. No, background.
That's pretty good.
All right. So let's rate it. So what do you guys rate this movie? What are your final thoughts?
Oh, man. I really want to give this one a 5-star rating. What did I give Beauty and the Beast? 5. Yeah, let's throw this one in the 5 pile. I mean, this one's got it all. I mean, this is the part of the pinnacle of the Disney Renaissance. Like, this is like as good as it was getting. And, you know, Disney was getting their fire back, and it was what was saving them. And you know, it's got the songs that are just amazing. There's not a song on this film that I don't like, you know. Mm-hmm. There's some Disney films where, like, you know, the song shows up and I'm like, okay, I'm going to go use the restroom, or okay, I'm going to go to the fridge, grab something.
Fast forward.
This one is like, yeah, this one is like, okay. Oh, no. You never fast forward through a Disney film.
Oh, I always do.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Sheesh.
Fast forward.
I'll give it 4.5 stars. It's not as great as Lion King and other stuff that I would consider a 5-star Disney animated feature. But it's still up there. Like, it's got amazing characters, awesome voices, and just, like, the whole, like, stew of animation, music, you know, and timing. It just makes this film, like, super special. Every little girl in the 90s wanted to be Ariel, you know, whether they were under the water in the pool.
Yes.
It's a childhood classic, and to me it'll always be a classic because, you know, of when we were born, right, Chelsea?
Right, exactly.
And, but so yeah, 4.5 stars. This film is amazing.
I'm going to give it 5 stars. I love the soundtrack on this one. Even all of the musical scores, I could listen to the entire thing and know exactly where in the movie it is and just be reliving the whole movie. It's great. I loved it. I've loved it ever since the beginning, since the beginning of my time. And it's just great. 5 stars.
I give it 4.5 stars. This was the beginning of a really, really great era. This was the start of the perfect storm, as you will. And this film has a few flaws here and there, and Disney builds on it in the next, you know, with Lion King and Beauty and the Beast. Those are really 5-star to me. And this is a 4.5 star. It's amazing. It's good. I'm not trying to say like, oh, you know, I'm going to compare it and make it less because those ones are better. There's just a few things here and there, but it has the music, has the animation, it has the story. It's a classic. And not my favorite, but very, very, very highly up there. When I say not my favorite, I mean like it's not 1 and 2. It's maybe like 4 and 5. So
yeah.
Yeah, definitely good. 4.5 stars.
Yay.
Woohoo. Thanks everybody for joining us for our 1-year anniversary episode. I cannot believe that we have been podcasting for a year.
Oh my gosh, it's been amazing.
Yeah, and so, I mean, it's just been really fun to, you know, step out and be a part of the animation community and the Disney community and the Pixar community and just share our thoughts and hear other people's, and it's been great. It's been really, really fun.
Mm-hmm. If you would like more information about the Rotoscopers, you can head on over to our website at www.therotoscopers.com. And if you have any questions about a specific episode, you just type in /, and then the number of the episode. You can also find us on Twitter at The Rotoscopers, on Tumblr as well, Facebook, Hypable.com. You know, these are all really great places you can find us.
And of course, you can find us at our individual locations. I'm on Twitter at Morgan Stradling. Chelsea's on Twitter at Chelsea Robson. And just go to chelsearobson.com. And of course, Mason, his blog, thisanimatedlife.blogspot.com. Also, don't forget to check out our newly formed YouTube channel. This is a place where, you know, if you want to read the reviews, go to the website. You can read our reviews of different Blu-rays, movies, and DVDs. But if you just want a quick 5-minute version of it, just go to the YouTube. And it's usually me and Chelsea, and we just sit there and we talk about the good, the bad, and what we liked about them. It's really fun. You get to kind of see, you know, first off, see what we look like. And then we're usually on our goofy mode for those. So there's definitely some funny ones and some blackmail-worthy ones there. We also, that's where we get to talk about things that maybe you know, an insider scoop where we talk about, you know, before the Frozen pictures were leaked. I mean, we talked about the Frozen pictures. So lots of good stuff on there. It's just really fun randoms place that you can just, you know, get a little dose of the Rotoscopers.
Also, make sure to head on over to our Amazon affiliate link if you want to look up the documentary Waking Sleeping Beauty. And if you're looking for anything on Amazon.com, going through our affiliate link, it's the same price to you, but it's a lot of help to us. So thank you so much for supporting the podcast in these ways. Or you can head on over to audible.com if you want to look up the book The Disney War or The Outliers, like what we were talking about earlier on in the episode. Those are all great places. But also, Netflix!
Netflix! In case you don't know, Netflix is awesome. And Netflix is an affiliate supporter of the podcast. So go to therotoscopers.com/Netflix and you can get a free trial and you can test it out. I mean, Disney movies are on there, DreamWorks movies. It's really a good place for $7 a month where you can get a whole bunch of animation right at your fingertips. So go to therotoscopers.com/Netflix for your free 1 month trial and you won't be disappointed.
Not at all.
So thank you so much for joining us for our 1 year anniversary party. Here's to another amazing year of animation and laughs and good times.
Okay.
Chelsea has a fancy mic, so she sounds like way better than both of us, but hopefully no.
Well.
I think I'm all high and mighty over here, just so you know.
Yeah, I bet you do.
Typical Chelsea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We should practice that laugh that Jafar and Iago do, where they're like, ha ha. Ha 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 ha. Ha 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 ha. Ha ha
ha. Anyway. Okay, and stop the fangirl, fanboy session. Yeah. Just kidding. You want to talk about this, Mason?
Yeah, sorry, I was cleaning my ear out.
that sounded weird.
So, sorry, excuse me.
One thing I really liked about the voice of this is actually the voice of, what is his name? He's on the Brady Bunch. Greg.
Are you kidding?
No.
That's Prince Eric?
Yeah, Greg from the Brady Bunch. And I cannot listen to his voice without thinking it's Greg from the Brady Bunch.
Yes, exactly. Hey, he never said he owned a lot.
Maybe he is the prince of, what is that, the smallest?
Thieves! Oh, never mind.
No. His father's.
That small little.
Yeah, it's Mars, right next to Marseille. It's
Genovia.
No, okay, let me think. It's Barcelona. Nice, Marseille.
Genovia.
Grace Kelly married into it. What was the name? Dang it. Oh, just continue.
Catalina Island.